Welcome to From the Booth, the podcast where we talk about the films playing at Brigham Young University's International Cinema Program. I'm Chip Oskerson, co-director of International Cinema, coming to you from Paris, France, where I've been leading an IC-themed study abroad. And I'm joined today by fellow co-directors Mark Yamada and interim director Greg Stallings at our home office in Provo. As always, Mark and Greg, good to be with you.
Great to be here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Today we're going to be discussing the films from the final week of international cinema for fall 2019, the films of the 4th through the 7th of December. These films included The Orphanage by J.A. Bayona from 2007, The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, an anime by Mamoru Hosoda from 2006, Enter the Dragon starring Bruce Lee from 1973, and the documentary I Am Bruce Lee by Pete McCormick from 2012. As always, in our discussion of these films that have already played at IC, we're going to presume that you've already seen them, so we won't be giving any spoiler alerts, but we do provide time codes in the program notes if you want to skip forward to preserve a future viewing experience. So this is the end of the semester. We, I think, ended with a bang here. The Orphanage was a film that when we were first putting together our program, we were thinking about it in terms of Halloween, and for various reasons, we needed to move it out of the Halloween slot, but it's a horror film. And Greg, this is a film you've taught before, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
What is it that stands out to you about this film?
Well, I think when it came out 10 years ago, it was so refreshing. And because of that, it was so well received. I understand it got a standing ovation for 10 minutes at Cannes.
Wow.
And I think
this his first film? Do I remember that?
Yeah, his first film. It was funded and produced and really supported by the mentor Bayona, the great Guillermo del Toro, who was by then very established. And I think it was so received because it's in the spirit of del Toro. Del Toro is well known and recognized now for practically inventing his own genre, his own form, which is often called the thinking person's horror film or the thinking man's scary movie. And it's a thriller that really thrills. It doesn't barrage you with gore and violence and stabbings. And it is suspenseful. It is influenced by the works of Alfred Hitchcock, for example. The Gloomy Mansion seems out of Psycho. It's also influenced by the great Norrish horror director from the 1940s, producer Val Lewton, whose most famous film today is Cat People. It has a lot of literary references, especially Peter Pan. So it is kind of this more intelligent thriller, but it really works with suspense. The starts and jolts and scary moments, he earns them and really paces the film well as far as suspense.
Yeah, it really it takes you through this whole gamut of emotions too. Like it's scary. And then by the end, there's this kind of beautiful sadness about it. So it's has that extra, not just kind of a scary film, but something that has this kind of pathos and this beautiful, the relationship between her and these children is really kind of beautiful. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, horror so often returns us to the home, right? It's about mothers and fathers and childhood and memory, right? That this is, what is the anxiety about homes that this is exploring, do you think?
Well, I read one time years ago that Stephen King was asked, what is the scariest thing that you can ever imagine? And he said, the loss of a child. And I think it's not just motherhood, but fatherhood and the attachments that we have with children. And at the same time, this film is in the tradition of other Spanish films, especially The Others by Alejandro Amenábar, which came out just a few years before this one. And of course, Guillermo del Toro's masterwork, the companion piece for Pan's Labyrinth, The Devil's Backbone, which is also set in an orphanage. So it's just the film that kind of makes people think, and everybody has their own take on it. Some people want to perhaps read in the history of Spain and life under Franco and repression. Guillermo del Toro is famous for his, what we call in Spanish, el perspectivismo. In other words, there are various perspectives that are in play that are possible. Famously, the end of Pan's Labyrinth, wherein we're not really sure if the whole returning to the presence of her father, Wizard of Oz kind of ending, really happened, or she was murdered and it was just a psychological kind of projection. In this film, there are several perspectives in play as well. Some people want to agree with the husband, Carlos, that Belén Rueda Laura is mentally projecting the whole thing. And there's another opinion out there that it's all the point of view of Carlos, the little boy. He goes into a cave at the beginning, and lots of echoes of Don Quixote, when Don Quixote, halfway through that famous novel, goes into a cave. He comes out, and ever since, people have been saying, critics have been saying, perhaps the whole second part of Don Quixote is a dream, is a mental projection of El Quixote. Hmm. At any rate, it's deeply felt. I agree. I was rewatching it recently, and the performance by Belén Rueda, who's the great actress from The Sea Inside, Mar Adentro, is so moving and so touching that I really shed tears.
Yeah,
you really do feel this kind of sadness and melancholy of her loss. And so it's a beautiful film, beautiful in every way, beautifully filmed and beautifully towed, rendered.
I think that's really interesting too, that this probing of the line between reality and paranoia, right? And I think that especially in our political discourse today, right, where there's so much, you know, talk of fake news and, you know, reality and kind of unreality and the difference in being able to tell the two, conspiracy theory, right, which is born out of a kind of a paranoia, that this is a really interesting place for us to go back to and to, you know, to think about that, you know, how close these are. They're difficult to separate, right? And, you know, it gives us an interesting way to take a step back and to think about some of those issues by putting it within a horror genre.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not nearly as overtly political or historical as The Devil's Backbone, and yet we all sense it's there. The idea of people that are traumatized because of, you know, really rigid systems, and how do you render that without delving into fiction? And so that line is always blurred. And I think it's, like you're saying, it's really important to be aware of how that line can be easily blurred.
Well, and even how reality is constructed out of our paranoia, right? They're not two discrete categories, but they bleed into each other, and, you know, with some astonishing effects sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And I personally think that all three or four well-known interpretations of the different perspectives, you know, number one, that it is a ghost story, ghosts really exist. Number two, it's all psychological, she's projecting. Number three, the little boy dreamt the whole thing. They're all equally valid, and they're all in play at the same time. And
that's good filmmaking, isn't it?
Yeah, Guillermo del Toro said he leaves those kinds of endings wide open. And there is a political dimension to his perspectivismo, because living under fascism, you're basically told there is one opinion, that of the great supreme leader, right? Who's trying to make Spain great again, or USA or Utah great again. Whereas these films tell you to entertain different points of view and to really think about your experience and think about storytelling and think about historical accounts of trauma and to really
embrace that kind of ambiguity, right?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And so to be careful before you kind of latch into just one rigid point of view or opinion or interpretation of history.
Yeah, I think that's really tricky art to, you know, to do it in a way where it's cohesive and it holds together, and yet it can support those kind of multiple perspectives and interpretations. I mean, that's the kind of art that we continue to return to, and we get something out of every time we go back to it. The ones that, you know, the art that's a little bit too didactic, it doesn't have a long shelf life. When the context of the moment passes, it doesn't continue to resonate with us in important ways. I think that's an important, you know, aspect of the, you know, the kinds of, you know, and there's place, I think, for both kinds of art, you know, clearly, but that's really what sets the kind of art that we, you know, we'll come back to. And, you know, here, this isn't the first time it's played at international cinema, you know, 10 years later, that we're still seeing that it's, you know, that it has something to say to us.
Yeah, exactly. Pan's Labyrinth, people still come up to me and say, when are you going to show that one again? The Devil's Backbone, when will you ever show it? Which is another issue, but
yeah, that's right.
For more complex works like these ones that at the same time, they entertain us.
Yeah. Well, Mark, tell us a little bit about A Girl Who Leapt Through Time. This too, I was noticing as I was preparing for today that this is one of the few weeks that we didn't have really any contemporary films. International cinema has kind of sided more towards, you know, the films that have come out in the last two or three years that tends to make up a big part of our program, but not this week, right? So here we have another film, 2006. So it's been a little over a decade since it came out. We've been showing the films of Mamoru Hosoda this semester. How do we understand this film within the context of other films, and how is it aging, maybe, is a question too.
Yeah, it's interesting. Orphanage and The Girl Who Led Through Time around the same time. I mean, these two films duked it out last week, right? With Spanish horror and Japanese anime.
You know, those are two of our biggest audiences, right?
That's right. You know, this is a film that, yeah, it is now 10 or 12, 13 years old. And so it's an earlier film in Mamoru Hosoda's work, and a film that I think in some ways plays with a common maybe plot structure of having this girl meets boy coming of age story that's put up against maybe a kind of a larger story that's going on in the larger world, some kind of conflict. This is a time travel story that's going on that kind of carries over several different historical periods. And so interesting way in which these two different genres are kind of brought together, this kind of larger sci-fi world genre and this coming of age story at the same time. There's some argument that this is a new genre of film, of TV, of anime, of this kind of world category, of kind of putting together attention, close attention to events in kind of the foreground of the world, of this kind of love relationship, and then juxtaposed against kind of a larger world without really attention to kind of middle ground. You know, people talk about this, the way in which maybe the way that we get information nowadays, news, you know, this direct Twitter way in which that we can kind of witness a big event and then be able to kind of broadcast it or talk about it, the way in which maybe kind of media and kind of the middle ground has fallen out a little bit in our contemporary discourse might be an effect on that. So, I mean, it's something that you'll see a lot in anime, this kind of world category genre that you see Mamoru using here a little bit in this anime in particular.
Yeah. So how does this fit in? We've showed several films from his work. The most recent, of course, is Mirai, right? That we showed at the beginning of the semester. How does this compare to where he's gone since? He said this is an early work.
Yeah. His films, he has a little bit more variety than a director like Makoto Shinkai, who seems to make in some ways a very similar film each time. He deals with different themes, Wolf Children, and this one's more of a time travel one. We saw Mirai a little bit earlier, which was also a little bit of a time travel thing, but more with family. But it seems like his films, this might get into a little bit of what we'll talk about with the series, but you know, he seems to be kind of this post-anime auteur or this post-auteur period in anime where it's not so much attention to like a Miyazaki who really has his stamp all over the films that he makes, and really more a product of collaboration. Even though his name gets attached to these films and there's a little bit of an auteur feel to them, in many ways his films are a product more of this collaborative process that goes on with animators, an increasingly decentered process that happens, you know, in global and kind of regional dimensions with anime artists in Korea and America and Japan all collaborating together to put the story together. And so I think in some ways he represents that in his films, and his films reflect that a little bit, this idea of things having to come together at the right time and everyone having to do their part, especially Mirai, where you have, you know, families as a product of these different relationships over time and how everyone has to do their part in order for everything to come together. And so I think you'll see that a little bit in his films. And it's nice to see that after, you know, Ghibli has really dominated the last 20 years or so. And Miyazaki's vision has really kind of been the forefront of anime, to see a little bit of a different way of putting it together.
I wonder, though, if we couldn't go back actually even to Miyazaki films, or better said, Studio Ghibli films, right? And tease out, you know, some of the collaborative nature of it. You know, is the reason that we talk about Miyazaki in the way that we do in part because by having an auteur, right, having an artist, a singular artistic vision behind the whole thing, somehow legitimate it more for for a broader audience? I mean, I think for a lot of diehard anime fans, they probably don't need that, right? That they're more comfortable with, you know, the idea of it being collaborative, and you know, they don't need, you know, these kinds of describe it exactly, these kind of paratextual discussions about, you know, art to make it legitimate, that this is somehow okay and higher art than than an animated film.
Yeah. No, and I think, I mean, and then it's not to say that, you know, film itself is, you know, films like Midnight Traveler are incredibly collaborative and they're involving, you know, several different directors and producers and people who are putting work into the film. And so anime in some ways reflects that. I mean, I think there is this way in which we do need to put a stamp on, I mean, a director, right? We need somebody who's...
It's a brand, right?
A brand. And I think, you know, I mean, it's something that Miyazaki might not be as comfortable with as maybe the marketing has tried to kind of create. Studio Ghibli is several different directors and he's kind of emerged because his vision has really caught the public imagination. But yeah, I think it is something that maybe goes back and forth, and that really at the height of Ghibli and maybe in the early 2000s and you know, right around that time, you had Miyazaki emerging as somebody who, you know, was kind of collaborating with Pixar. And I think John Lasseter, who was with Pixar, was kind of really promoting him as kind of the face of Ghibli, something that maybe kind of... And so, yeah, what I think I really like about anime and also film is that there is this really interesting collaboration that goes on. And in some ways, films and anime in particular, there's a little bit of a gamble that goes on, right? As different people come together and there's not always a singular vision. I see in Midnight Travelers a little bit of a gamble in the sense that can everything come together and not necessarily a singular artistic vision that organizes it.
Well, it's interesting too, because you mentioned that there's this globalized nature behind the production. There certainly is among the reception too, that the way that anime travels as a genre is, right. I find fascinating. And that we went to a film the other night here in Paris that we were previewing a film for next semester, an anime film. And there's this diehard anime culture, right? That you find here that's, you know, and there's different kind of niche cultures like this within film, I think. But anime definitely has a very developed and extensive network of eclectic. I mean, these people don't all watch the same kinds of films outside of anime, which I just find fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting. I there's something about anime too in the way that it's created. I know that there, in Japan in particular, there's markets for really particular animation and stories, and you'll have a very few, like a very small consumer demographic. And the artists are kind of making them for this very small group, and there's a personal kind of element to it, and so there definitely is a little bit of a sense of a personalized feel that and people go to different films for different reasons.
Yeah. Oh, well, I really appreciate you bringing some of these, you know, other than Ghibli animes to the attention of, you know, those of us who just, you know, didn't know enough about it. So it's been good. And we're going to continue with this some next semester as well. The last two films from this past week are Enter the Dragon, which is directed by Robert Klaus, but of course it stars Bruce Lee. This is Bruce Lee's final completed film before his death, you know, at the all too young age of 32 in 1973. And I think is probably one of his best films, most complete films in some ways. And this we paired this with this documentary, I Am Bruce Lee. And I think that we'll, you know, can talk about them, you know, both in tandem. You know, Bruce Lee is someone that, you know, I've grown up, you know, knowing about. These films came out before I was old enough to really be going to films. So Bruce Lee films have always kind of, you know, just existed. One of the reasons we wanted to go back and revisit this film now is that throughout the semester that we were featuring films that were looking at questions of representation of race, of Chinese-ness, kind of Chinese diaspora that is Chinese outside of China. You know, what does that look like? And you need to engage Bruce Lee because he's such an important figure in the exportation of different kinds of things that now we associate so closely with Chinese-ness. And some of it has, you know, of course, been taken on and orientalized in different ways in the West. But he's a real important exporter of particularly Hong Kong film to the United States.
Yes. Well, you know, Professor Matt Ansel from Comparative Arts and Letters here gave a really great talk. Greg introduced it. Last Wednesday and really kind of gave it like this.
Yeah, there's a good summary of that talk on the website too, if people want to go find it.
It's a great one to listen to. He really did his homework on it and knows his stuff. But I think what's interesting about Bruce Lee, you know, and I think with this series, I think we look at films sometimes and we want them to have a particular political message that is cohesive and coherent. And I think we always have to look at films as somewhat incoherent in the sense that they're promoting certain ideas, but they're also in some ways, maybe in the case of, you know, some of the films that we saw for the Chinese diaspora, in some ways they were kind of breaking through stereotypes. In other ways, they were reinforcing stereotypes.
Sure, right.
That are traditional, you know, and I think, Enter the Dragon, we do have this stereotype of this kind of Chinese martial arts kind of thing. And I think that film certainly reinforces that.
But in some ways it was creating that. I mean, it was the first, so it wasn't necessarily building on a stereotype, is creating a new kind of idea that then became picked up and recircled, you know, circulated so many times that it becomes stereotypical.
Right. So it's kind of creating a lot of these genre conventions that we often have in film nowadays, where it seems like in film, we do get this weird kind of action cinema in particular. We get this kind of weird marriage of martial arts and maybe a little bit of blaxploitation and mm-hmm. even some kind of James Bond stuff. So it seems like it's early there where it's kind of bringing together some of these proven action genres from around the world. And I think that's why it's such an interesting film, because it's really kind of this product of globalization, right? Where you have Hong Kong film, you have an actor who has become more Chinese, at least in people's minds, but really was very cosmopolitan, is part European, right?
Right.
Child actor, spent some time in the United States, and was in some ways seen early on, at least, as kind of an outsider to Hong Kong. So it's really been embraced since then, but really kind of this cosmopolitan global product of bringing together several different genres into one film that feels a little clunky at times, right?
Yeah.
That you're working with so many things, but, you know, obvious connection to James Bond and the way you have this, you know, this lair and this mastermind villain. And then, you know, organizing a kind of a kung fu competition as a way of creating that plot connection. So.
Well, and you have these three, I mean, it is interesting that you have these three different protagonists. Right. And you're not sure if they're going to be, you know, going head to head or kind of collaborating, right? And they represent different sorts of aspects. You have the one, you know, that is kind of a James Bond type. You have another that the African American character who brings another kind of attitude and kind of way of being, you know, to it. And then you have Bruce Lee, who's a kind of third. And and it's a little bit uncomfortable marriage of all of these kinds of things. But you've got to applaud the effort, right? That this, you know, this attempt to try to bring, I mean, there's something very, very global about a film, you know, that really at its core is a Hollywood film. And, but surprising in that ambitious kind of effort to reach outside of that and to try and think its way through, you know, this kind of messiness of genres that it's, you know, puts itself in the middle.
Yeah. And it certainly is a mess, but I think you're right there. There is, you know, and added to the mess is the fact that I think, you know, Bruce Lee wanted, from what I understand, Bruce Lee wanted to add a little bit more of a Chinese philosophy to it. So there's the beginning where he has this fight, and there's a little bit more of this kind of Taoist worldview that's presented. And then the end, which kind of echoes that a little bit, where there's this idea of illusion and kind of non-action, right, of fighting without fighting, which is kind of this weird, the American actors are very much conflict-oriented, and then he tries throughout the film to kind of be this, to kind of take on that, you know, that fight without fighting, the like water that, you know, you crash, but you also flow at times. And so it is this really kind of strange mixture of several different things going on. And all in within the story of this kind of kung fu competition.
Right. Well, so, and in the context of early 1970s too. So one of the things that, you know, in watching this film, I couldn't watch past are things like the misogyny that is not addressed at all. Right. It's just kind of there. And I don't think for a 1970s audience, it was obvious as it is for us today, that it's like, you just don't talk that way. You don't treat, you know, kind of women that way in film. You don't show them that way. And it seems to be completely unaware of itself in that regard. And I think, you know, we had this internal discussion a little bit about, well, what do we do with some of that? Is that, you know, we certainly don't want it to be perceived that, you know, international cinema as a program is promoting or endorsing or, you know, any of these things. Right. But I think it's important as well to confront some of those kinds of things, not to simply act like they were never part of our discourse. Because by doing so, we see, oh, there's ways in which these kinds of things even persist, right? That genre, you know, insofar that, that films are kind of playing to a genre, sometimes have hard baked into their very structure some of these things that are a little bit uncomfortable. And so when we go back and we revisit them, maybe that helps us be more aware of what we're doing, how we're expressing, how we're talking about, you know, different sorts of things today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, if you take the James Bond genre and you take blaxploitation, a lot of the masculinities, the, you know, are created vis-a-vis this kind of treatment towards women. And so I think you're going to, you know, in order to kind of transplant that into the film, you're going to, that's going to be kind of a residual thing, right, of constructing male characters in relation to kind of women and the treatment of women. And it's something that, again, I hope that, you know, and I think this, I explained this to the class and we talked a lot about this, but we want to present films and present them not so much as messages from us about what our politics are, but as maybe reflections of a particular time period of genres, of anxieties, of historical issues, and look at them for both what they, you know, what they say, and maybe read them against the grain and show how they're problematic at the same time. And I hope that, and I think most of our audience members can appreciate that idea that we're, that these films, we have to look at them in the context of, you know, the 1970s and the genres that are influencing them.
That's right. Well, and the I Am Bruce Lee documentary, just to touch on that briefly here at the end, was really helpful for me in understanding how Bruce Lee is breaking barriers, you know, kind of within 1970s culture, right? I mean, this representation of an Asian male that is not kind of a supporting actor, is not playing this marginal kind of role, but, you know, but is the center of the film. And, you know, this is pretty groundbreaking in how important that was, not only for Chinese American audiences or Chinese audiences for that matter, as this eventually makes its way back to, you know, to Hong Kong and, you know, into China even, but as well for African American audiences, that this was, that he was a very popular figure because he represented the marginalized and the, you know, the forgotten man who is able to kind of assert himself and take on this kind of presence and become the hero.
Yeah, it's an interesting case of kind of transnational sense of kind of marginalization that extends. I mean, in some of Bruce Lee's films, you'll have callbacks to Japanese occupation of China and the, you know, the marginalization of Chinese and kind of the abuse. And there's a sign in one of his films that says, "No Chinese allowed." And I think that's something that, you know, Black audiences can relate to, you know, and can understand this idea of this history of oppression. Mm-hmm. And then having a hero who doesn't look like somebody who, you know, would be your oppressor, you know, is not this kind of stereotypical white action hero, but somebody who isn't necessarily Black, but is, doesn't look like, you know, the man, right? Is kind of the idea there. So there's that interesting kind of connection that Kung Fu films and Bruce Lee in particular have with Black culture during the 70s, also because of kind of the play that a lot of the Kung Fu films got. I mean, you know, Kung Fu films, I was looking at the cinematography of Enter the Dragon and a lot of zooms, right? Cheaper than doing cuts. You know, you have a lot of zoom shots in order to kind of really...
The 70s love zooms.
And it's a way of kind of making films in a cheaper budget. And so they're shown for... You can see them cheaply and they were shown a lot in inner city theaters. And so all that adds up to a really interesting connection, transnational connection between Bruce Lee and kind of Hong Kong and African-American culture in the 70s.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Okay, well, let's turn our attention now to thinking a little bit as the semester as a whole. We had several series, some running through the semester and some that just went on for a week. The series-long semesters included the Mamoru Hosoda anime series that we've talked a little bit about already. We, of course, had our documentary series where we have a documentary film that plays every week. And we had our international noir series that ran through the semester. Mark, which of these series kind of stood out to you as particularly successful in terms of how they put films in dialogue with each other?
Yeah, I think, you know, representing race and Chinese diaspora were linked in some ways just because we were looking at characters and stories that were maybe outside of this traditional, what we've kind of labeled as, or what's been labeled as the white gaze, this way of traditionally looking at African-American characters, Chinese characters, and seeing them both as, in some ways, in stereotypical ways, but also through new perspectives with the Chinese diaspora. We had two characters in The Farewell and Crazy Rich Asians who were both ethnic Chinese, but also outsiders in the Chinese community, which creates an interesting, you know, difference, and it really kind of breaks up homogeneity that we usually associate with certain kind of ethnic identities. With Green Book and Beale Street Could Talk, it was an interesting kind of contrast between those two films and looking at the way in which Black characters are framed through a little bit more of a traditional white gaze kind of genre style, and then one in which characters are giving a little bit more of a sense of humanity in the story and in their lives in that way.
Yeah, I think that putting those two series in relief to each other was really helpful. I mean, even thinking about a film like Crazy Rich Asians, which got so much attention for featuring this Asian American or Asian cast, which is, you know, so rare in Hollywood, to go back to Bruce Lee and think about this earlier moment where something similar is actually, you know, taking place, right, know, back in 1973, that's a really interesting bookends to the semester to think about them, yeah, you know, next to each other. I really like the International Noir series. And what it really reminded me is just how we talk about genres, and genre kind of means something to us, but genres can be so flexible. And the way that, one, the genre of noir has emerged, it starts in Europe, it gets exported to the United States, it becomes something in the United States and then re-imported back into Europe, and then becomes a kind of more solidified thing as the Americans look at what the Europeans are doing with it. And, right, and then it goes out again. I mean, it's truly kind of grown and changed with every period. And the films that we showed were speaking to each other in terms of the formal features, that it was using things that made them identifiable as part of something that, you know, a tradition that holds together, and yet so versatile and different as well.
Yeah.
The way that it's used in Scandinavia, as opposed to the way that it was used in Hollywood, that there's certain commonalities about anxieties of times of moral turbulence and change, and that these are getting expressed in a similar kind of way, even though the context are vastly different. I really thought that was a productive thing that came out of that.
Yeah, the cynicism of noir, I think, is a valuable tool of looking at, you know, oftentimes in, you know, some of the ones that we looked at with Double Indemnity and Mildred Pierce and High and Low, they're all kind of taking place during, you know, like a post-war economic development, reasonably happy time. I mean, these aren't kind of dystopian settings. And yet the cynicism allows us to kind of see below that and see how things aren't as functioning maybe as we thought, and the problems of society and kind of the dark corners of the city that are maybe ignored during this time.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that there's in some ways been an interesting resurgence of noir in the post 9/11 world, is that there's a lot of the things that kind of echo with us, and that this realization of the way that things are connected across borders, that there's, you know, again, a kind of moral ambiguity that, you know, that has emerged in a world where it's not always easy to tell who your friends and who your enemies are, what's right or what's wrong, you know, even in kind of a global context. You know, we kind of become nostalgic for the, you know, these moments where there seemed to be this great moral clarity, you know, the good fight, right, the good war, whatever. That resonates, you know, very much. One of the other series that I neglected to mention was the Bridges and Walls series that ran through the whole semester too. And this was in connection with what was going on at the Kennedy Center this semester. And we had an entire week that was looking at the Berlin Wall, which is a nice kind of healthy, you know, 30 years on, you know, retrospective going. But one of my favorite films that had to do with bridges and walls, more walls than bridges probably, that were part of this, was actually much more contemporary, and was Midnight Traveler. This, you know, story about the refugees who are crossing borders from Afghanistan, you know, into Europe, all of these borders, and the immediacy of that film really, I don't know, there's something about it that really spoke to me.
Yeah, it's and the way that it's shot and the way in which people could really kind of connect with this idea of a family who's documenting their travel and their trip and their movements to find safety, I think is something that really resonated with the audience. And it was great to have the filmmaker here to talk about the process of putting that together. Emily did a great job.
Yeah, the documentary series, I think, has been a nice addition in recent years to what we do at International Cinema, because it allows for a different kind of storytelling. And, yeah. And you know, a lot of times these films are films that are not going to be, I don't know, some of them aren't going to have a long shelf life because they're dealing with very specific issues today. But it seems like it's been an interesting thing to have them be showing in the context of these other feature films and to give a little bit of depth to some of these things. And some of them are quite different. I think of a film like Disappearance of My Mother. This is another one that I really liked. I don't know how to classify this documentary film, but you know, this film about, you know, a son filming, you know, his favorite model, that is his mother from the, you know, she was a supermodel in the 1960s. And it was as much about him as it was about her. And I really like that kind of reflexive, you know, filmmaking that sometimes that's a little bit harder to get at in a feature film.
Yeah, that's true. Memories of War, They Shall Not Grow Old was another one that really kind of drew attention to the medium and the way in which sometimes technical kind of mediation of film, you think that in some ways, you know, and this has been a lot of, there's been a lot of this in Hollywood and in Martin Scorsese's recent film, The Irishman has been talked about as doing this, of kind of, you know, de-aging characters and the effect that it has. And in some ways there's this kind of distancing, this kind of dehumanizing that goes on. But it's interesting how in this film, in They Shall Not Grow Old, that there's almost more of a, it brings out kind of the human element. You're able to kind of connect with the characters in a way that you couldn't with this original documentary footage.
Yeah. So give me what some of your absolute favorites from the semester, or ones that you felt played particularly well this semester with our audiences.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I was surprised. We had the help of the Peary Film Festival, and that really boosted our attendance to Midnight Traveler. And I thought that along with having the director, Emily Madavian, come and talk about the film and do this, you know, hour-long Q&A after, I think was the total package. I thought was so great. It was really great to have the audience so engaged in a discussion. So that was one that really stuck out to me.
Yeah, I think that one of my favorite documentaries, I mentioned Midnight Traveler, but another one is Gaza. It was so beautifully shot, and it spurred a lot of interesting thoughts, thinking about the political crisis and the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. I like the way that it really tried to allow the people of Gaza to speak for themselves and to avoid some of the usual ways that we talk about it. I think that for a documentary, that was one of my favorites. In terms of feature films, Embrace of the Serpent was one that caught me by surprise. I didn't, I'd heard a little bit about it, but then when I saw it, I really fell in love with this film. Visually, I think it, you know, it's just so stunning, this black and white, the style in which it's shot, the ambiguity of what you're experiencing with these intertwined storylines, that this is a film that, you know, spoke to me and I'll want to go back and see again.
Yeah. I think for, you know, just pure formal beauty, I really loved Columbus and the way that every, you know, shot was just this kind of well-constructed, symmetrical kind of, you know, in some ways reflecting the architecture that is the subject of the film.
Yeah. No, that's a good semester. We have good things to look forward to next semester too. All right. Well, Greg, Mark, thank you so much for the discussion today. Appreciate you giving your thoughts on these films.
Thank you. Thank you for a great semester.
Yeah, always fun.
Okay, that's a wrap for fall 2019. Thank you for joining us today and this entire semester on From the Booth. Our podcast is produced by the International Cinema Program at BYU and supported by the BYU College of Humanities. The host and guest of this podcast are solely responsible for the opinions and ideas expressed here, as they don't necessarily represent any official position adopted by the university or its supporting institutions. Big thanks go out to our sound engineer, Jojo Hegstrom-Pratt, for the work every week on the podcast. We'll be back with our next season at the beginning of next year. We will preview the films for the coming winter 2020 schedule. So when we do, I'll see you both back again in Provo.
We'll see you then. Thank you.
See you then.